The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana, bringing Montanans together to learn and reflect for 40 years, and by listeners like you.
Why did Jackie Collins read your novel?
Jackie Collins was everything to me growing up. I'm from a small town in Montana, Troy, Montana. The public library wasn't too keen on lending a 10-year-old boy suggestive books, so I had to seek out the trash elsewhere, and I found it in a glorious spinning rack in our grocery store, used Jackie Collins paperbacks, and the first one I read was Lucky. It's part of her Santangelo saga. I, you know, just devoured those books because it was everything that I wasn't. You know, it was a great grand world out there full of sex and jewelry and high fashion and everything that I didn't have growing up. I mean, I knew I was a different child growing up in Troy, Montana, so that was my escape. And Jackie Collins was kind of my entree into adult literature. And, you know, I continued to read everything she put out. And I would loan the Jackie Collins books, of course, to my girlfriends and my sisters and any adult woman that looked like she needed to read Jackie Collins.
This is a great story. Let's just pause for 30 seconds while I let people know what they're listening to. This is The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Richard Fifield about his debut novel titled The Flood Girls, recently published by Simon & Schuster. All right, let's go back to your explanation of why Jackie Collins read your book. What happened next?
Then, you know, I went to college here at the University of Montana and went to Sarah Lawrence for graduate school, and I was a pretty rock-bottom drug and alcohol addict. And I never thought I was going to write again when I got sober. It's been 10 years now. And, you know, I just kind of assumed that writing was going to be something that I could only do high or drunk. I was scared. Then 7 years into my recovery, my therapist threw a Moleskine journal at me and said, go write a novel. And I was like, all right. So I went into the woods and I wrote this novel. And I came back from the woods, and it was around Halloween, and Jackie Collins was having a costume contest on Twitter for her favorite Halloween costume. You would just tweet the picture of it, and she would choose one winner. And I was a gay angel of death, and it was a hot glue gun extravaganza. It was pretty over the top, but Jackie loved it, and she picked me as the winner. And I was, you know, totally stoked because I had just written this book. She features, you know, in bits and pieces of this book. And her assistant sent me 2 signed Jackie Collins books. And in one of them, she had written, always believe in yourself. You can do anything. And that was just kind of a little bit of the faith and the hope that I needed. So when it came time 2 years later, after the whole saga of finding a publisher and an agent and selling the book, they asked me if I had anybody in mind to send the book out to get blurbs. And Jackie Collins was like, of course I'm going to send it to Jackie. It's about her. She'll love it. So I happened to have her secretary's email still from that. Of course, I saved it. And so I sent her a little note saying, you know, my book's coming out. It's Jackie features in a minor role in it. Would she like to read it? And she was like, sure. And Jackie got back to me the next day. Sent it off to her, and within a month, I had this great blurb from Jackie Collins, which was just like, oh, my God. And what's sad is 4 months before the book was set to be released, Jackie died of cancer. And doing the math, she had said in People magazine that she'd known she was dying for the last 9 months. She just didn't tell anybody. But the idea that she spent a day or 2 days or 3 days of the last days of her life reading this book by this hillbilly kid in Montana. And it was a galley. I mean, it wasn't like a published book or anything. And she spent her precious, precious moments reading my book just devastates me. And I could just picture her sitting on her leopard print couch reading The Flood Girls and then sending out what turned out to be the last blurb that she ever gave to a book. So I kind of feel like she's been the angel guiding this whole thing. I have a weird Jackie Collins shrine with a softball glove and a candle and a picture of her. And it just means so much that I got to share this with her and that she took time, precious time. I mean, if I had 9 months to live, I certainly wouldn't be reading manuscripts from weirdo gay kids from Montana, but she did. She took the time. And that's also really inspired me to be as humble and grateful and gracious as I possibly can during this process.
Wow. I threw that question in at the very end of my thought process before I came to talk with you. What a story.
It's a good thing I drank 3 energy drinks before I came here. I can talk really fast.
All right. Let's talk about the Flood Girls. It's the title of the book, but the Flood Girls in the book, Rachel and her mother. Mm-hmm. Tell us who these characters are.
Rachel is in recovery. She's got a year.
An alcoholic.
She was definitely an alcoholic, but as a teenager, she was the wild child of her hometown. Much more dangerous than an alcoholic. She was a homewrecker. And in a town of 900 people, that's just something they can't forget or forgive. And so she left town as soon as she could. And, you know, part of recovery is making amends to people, making things right. And so she's returned home for the first time in 9 years to make things right in her small town. Her mom, Laverna, is a force of nature. I know lots of women like Laverna. Women who have been burned one too many times and take it out on those around them. Laverna is imperious. I guess that's the best word I can use to describe her. She is the queen of this small town, surely by force. She wasn't appointed. She's just kind of steamrolled everything and everyone in her path. And she's proprietor of a bar called the Dirty Shame, which is an actual bar in Troy, well, in the Yak, and the name was just too good not to use. In addition to the two main characters having the last name Flood, the Flood Girls is also the name of the local town softball team, which the Floods are a part of. It functions as, you know, a double thing. It's not just the Flood Girls, Laverna and Rachel. It's also the Flood Girls, the softball team.
The team for the Dirty Shame Bar. There's a lot of drinking going on in this book.
Yes, there is.
By a lot of the characters. Alcoholism is a main theme in the story, mm-hmm. and as you said, it's something that you experienced. Mm-hmm. So did you intentionally make alcohol really a big part of your story?
You know, they say that your first book is a culmination of all of your years before you wrote it. So it was 40 years of living crammed into that book. So my next book's not going to be about much. But yeah, I mean, definitely my own experience colored the character of Rachel. I speak a lot to people about recovery, and their stories mean so much to me. And there's a depth in that pain and in that searching for forgiveness and moving past shame and guilt and learning to be authentic and be okay with yourself, no matter who and what kind of damage you incurred upon a community. You have to be able to forgive yourself. And I just think that's probably the most compelling theme in literature for me. I always am drawn to those kinds of stories.
So as the story opens, Rachel is coming back to town to try to make amends because she has sent letters to her mother, which her mother has
never
returned,
opened, yes.
Unopened, except for the one that had the $1,000 check in it. Miraculously, she cashed the check. But we find out early on that Laverna Flood does not like her own daughter, and we don't find out why for a while. But here's a quote from the book near the beginning. Laverna thought of Rachel the same way she thought about the time her appendix had burst. Sometimes things could come from inside your body and suddenly betray you, nearly killing you. So this is how the story opens. Rachel's back in town. Laverna is just trying to ignore her. And we don't want to spoil the plot for
Never.
Potential readers by saying why Laverna doesn't like her daughter specifically. But we can say the rest of the town doesn't like her. Mm-hmm. So explain what's going on there.
Well, she was a disaster as a teenager. I was always drawn to those types of girls in real life. I always befriended the girls that push things a little too far. I think because I wanted so badly to be them and to live without fear or without reservations. And I'm still attracted to those kinds of girls now. The town of Quinn is not at all like the town where I grew up. The town I'm from is very, it's much kinder, and it's just a sweetheart of a town. But Quinn is a town that's constantly waiting for a natural disaster. It's a town that's been lost to wildfire, and the people are like that. They're just kind of always waiting for the next explosion to happen. And Rachel definitely set off her fair share of bombs as a high schooler.
Well, she was what we call, when we're in high school, a slut.
Yes.
And she slept with inappropriate men.
Yes.
Destroyed some marriages.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I really set out to write a book that I wanted to read. I hope that makes sense. And I just don't see very often accounts of women who are unapologetic about their sexuality and women who, you know, it doesn't eat them up. Like, that's my favorite part about Rachel, is that she's more concerned about making amends for her alcoholism than she is about cleaning up her sexual past. And I kind of am a member of the fourth wave feminist crew, where it's, you know, through social media and through culture and advocacy. And I just wanted to write about a woman who wasn't ashamed of her sexuality and used it in inappropriate ways. And it didn't destroy her. And she didn't get a comeuppance at the end. I don't see that very often in literature. And I find those types of characters endlessly interesting.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Richard Fifield about his debut novel, The Flood Girls. If you'd like to listen again or share this program with a friend, you'll find it available as a podcast and at our blog. Links to both are at mtpr.org/twq. There are also links on our Facebook and Twitter pages. After a short break, we'll be back to hear a passage from The Flood Girls and find out what Kirkus Reviews said about the ending of the book. Stay with us. Rachel is not only in town to make amends, she's in town because her father has died.
Mm-hmm.
So she moves into his trailer house, which is next door to her former high school best friend,
mm-hmm.
who has a 12-year-old son, Jake.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd just like you to read the first part of the first chapter where we meet Jake.
Okay. Harmonica, December 1990. Every night, Frank played harmonica for the cats. Jake Bailey watched as the feral creatures emerged from the carcass of a 1978 Ford Granada, from the piles of fiberglass insulation beneath the skeleton of a trailer that had been immolated by fire. The cats were skittish around people, yet they came to his neighbor's yard each evening. At 7 o'clock sharp, Frank would play his harmonica and put out cans of food, and the cats would gather and rub up against his legs. The two would talk to each other while Jake sat in a lawn chair on the roof of his trailer house. Jake's mother, Crystal, found it odd that Frank talked at all, told Jake that Frank was the shyest person in Quinn, the only permanent stranger in a town of 956. Unlike Frank, his mother was well known, and as a nurse, she was useful. His mother refused to wear any makeup despite her thin lips. Crystal had enormous green eyes and glossy brown hair that hung past her shoulder blades, content to be a natural beauty. She wore her hospital scrubs at home and no jewelry. Jake found it frustrating to shop for his mother. Jake had been coming to the rooftop since he was 7 years old, when Crystal stopped noticing what he was doing as long as he was in the yard. From the roof, Jake could see all of the trailer court and parts of the town. He was 12 now, and he no longer spied on his neighbors. After 5 years, he realized that they were gross. Now he came to the roof for refuge. The space belonged to him, and he furnished it with a lawn chair and a waterproof tub that held his paperbacks, a parasol, and a pile of cassette singles. He sat on the roof through most of the year, sat there for hours, even in winter, when he sat until he could no longer bear it. His perch had revealed who was having affairs with the UPS man, who was eating too much when they thought nobody was watching, who was stealing checks from mailboxes. Jake was not a private detective, but he had a private detective outfit. He also had several piles of polyester leisure suits and a complete set of motorcycle leathers. Jake listened only to Madonna when he was on the roof. He listened to Madonna and watched the sky instead of the dirty loop of trailer houses. It was too painful to regard his tiny universe. The town seemed so foreshortened and filthy. His Walkman had a voracious appetite, and Jake had lost many cassettes, had tried to repair the ribbon when it stretched and wound until it broke. He fixed most of them with a cunning little piece of scotch tape, and it usually worked. Only a little blip and squeal before the gospel choir kicked in during Like a Prayer. He had found rosary beads at the thrift store, and he wore these as he listened to Madonna, even though he was not religious. He wore three necklaces at a time: glass, baby blue stones, and wood. He knew he was supposed to say a prayer and finger every bead, but instead he named his enemies. It seemed impossible that he had 59 enemies, but the football team took up 32. And there are 27 other bullies and assholes in town. According to Jake's math, he disliked 1/16 of the town. Frank was not one of them. The cats came around despite the freezing weather. Some nights, Frank built a tiny fire in a washtub. He played his harmonica, surrounded by piles of empty cans of cat food, and the flames shone on the tins and cast the snowy yard in waves of reflected light. When Frank wasn't playing music, he recited facts and observations to Jake. The harmonica was the Special 20, model number 560, manufactured by Hohner, a plastic comb instead of wooden. Frank told Jake that feral cats woke at 4 in the afternoon, that their hunting parties went out at 6, and then they went back to sleep after he fed them. The cats woke again at 3 in the morning, foraged for the next 3 hours, slept all day. Jake thought they were much like Bert, Crystal's boyfriend. Bert was a human barnacle that had attached itself to Jake and Crystal's trailer house in 1989. He courted them with shopping trips to Spokane, boxes of garage sale books, a new furnace for the trailer. He promised to be a father figure. As soon as Bert moved in, he never moved again, leaving the couch only to go to the bar. He was surly and possessive, drunk and useless, and worst of all, fertile. Crystal was pregnant within a month. Before Bert came, Frank had built a small storage shed for Jake, shoved up against the siding between the back door and Jake's bedroom window. Frank knew that Jake's thrift store purchases were piled to the ceiling in his bedroom, each article of clothing perfectly folded, but sandwiched so tightly that Jake was constantly ironing. Frank worked silently, building the shed out of cedar, so Jake's clothes would smell less like old people and more like expensive people. He added a gambrel roof, sturdy enough to support Jake's weight. Now Jake could climb out of his bedroom window and use the roof of the storage shed to push himself up to the flat metal panels on the top of the trailer house. After Bert moved in, Frank built a privacy fence around his entire property in the summer of 1990. Bert had started trapping Frank's feral cats in the alley, collecting them in metal cages. He drove to the boating launch and threw the cages in the shallows of the river. Bert described this process in detail, but was secretive about what he did with the bodies. Frank's fence was 6 feet high, enough to shield Frank from the sight of Bert drinking in the yard, the sight of Bert entirely.
You had a lot of fun with the names in this book. There are several volunteer firemen named Jim, mm-hmm. and then there are two Mabels. Tell us about the Mabels.
You know, the Mabels, when I've been asked who my favorite character in the book is, I always say Black Mabel. I just love her. She's the type of person that is always trying to do good but failing spectacularly. Red Mabel is... she's like a bear. I guess that's the best way to put it. She is Laverna's henchman, and she uses her physicality to, I guess, be Laverna's bodyguard. And everyone in town is terrified of her. Both Mabels are on the outskirts of society in Quinn, if there is a society in Quinn. They're always both in trouble with the law. Black Mabel for selling drugs and possessing drugs, and Red Mabel for poaching and fist fighting. They function for me as kind of stand-ins for myself, I guess. I get to really get into the nitty-gritty of Quinn with Red Mabel and Black Mabel and how people respond to each of them. Red Mabel instills fear in people, and Black Mabel instills loathing in people. And we all know people like that. So they're two sides of a really nasty coin, I guess.
And then the volunteer firemen, all the Jims, where did that come from?
The weirdest thing about living in a small town is there just seems to be a surplus of the same names for people. I mean, nicknames are everything in a small town. I don't know if it's a lack of inventiveness or what. I was grateful to be the only Richard in my small town, but there are always multiple Jims and multiple Jessies, and there aren't a lot of spectacularly individual names. So you have to come up with pretty inventive ways when you're talking about so-and-so to get the message across to avoid confusion.
The story also takes place in a time when the TV show that had Daryl and my brother Daryl and
Newhart,
my other
yes.
brother Daryl.
Yes, yes.
Kirkus gave the book a really glowing review with one minor criticism. The book, and I quote, includes bar fights and AA meetings, a parade, a wedding, and a black bear, all of which Fifield juggles beautifully until the ending, which feels both inevitable and wrong. Read it anyway, they say. Can you say why you chose a tragedy without giving away what the tragedy is?
I started out writing the book towards an event. It's the second to last chapter in the book. I always had that picture in my mind, and I knew that I wanted to write the book towards that event. To me, that's my favorite chapter in the book, is the second to last chapter. There are people who do not like the ending, and there are people who think the ending makes the book more than just a women's story, if you would, a women's fiction. And I'll take that label happily all day. But it's, if that particular thing hadn't happened in the book, I don't think I would have sold the book, honestly. We're encouraged to find arcs for our characters. And if that particular thing hadn't happened, there wouldn't have been a landing for those arcs, if you will. But how people react to that event really shows their true colors. And it just had to happen. And I apologize to people who abhor that thing. And there have been many reviews, especially on Amazon, about, you know, how it made them throw the book across the room. And I'm like, well, if it inspired you to throw a book across the room, then it was worth it for me.
Yeah, if you get that stronger reaction to something you've written, then you know you're touching somebody in some way.
You know, my agent warned me that many publishers would ask me to change the ending. And thankfully, when the book went to auction, Simon & Schuster were the high bidders, and Allison Callahan Kilkelly said, nope, we're keeping the ending. And so I knew I'd made the right choice.
I think you made the right choice also, as Kirkus said, inevitable and wrong. And and I don't mean wrong in that you wrote it, but wrong that it happened.
And you have to think about when the book took place. 1991 may seem relatively, you know, like it was a couple years ago, but it wasn't. There was no internet. There was no pop culture. There was no acceptance in 1991.
There was no gay marriage. There was no...
There was nothing. Yeah. Yeah. There really wasn't. I mean, I can tell you because I lived through it. We had Richard Simmons, and, you know, that was about it as far as queers in the media to look up to. There just wasn't such a thing. And in 1991, fear was still huge and running rampant. And with the stories of AIDS coming from both coasts and then inside of America, it just kind of still was manifesting itself in terrible, terrible ways. So in 1991, I don't think the ending is that far-fetched. In 2016, I do.
I really love your bio on your website.
Thank you.
And I wonder if you would just mind reading the first little bit of that. I printed it out here
thank
for you.
Sure. I never thought my first novel would be about sports. I grew up in a small town in Montana, just like Quinn. For my fourth birthday, my mother bought me a subscription to TV Guide, which I read and studied like the Bible, even though we would not get cable or a VCR for another 7 years. When I was six, I discovered my older sister's hope chest, where she kept her cigarettes and trashy books. I believe I was the only person to find hope there. Her romance novels caused my homosexuality. Don't believe the scientists. I always wanted to be a writer. I lived in books, especially the forbidden ones. My mother was married 5 times, truly impressive for a town of 900 people, and owned a gas station, so she didn't have much time to monitor my choice of reading materials. At the grocery store, there was a swinging rack of used paperbacks, all books the town librarian declared off-limits for a grade schooler. Here is where I discovered Stephen King, Jackie Collins, and the entire Flowers in the Attic series. Here is where I devoured true crime novels, always split in thirds by lurid photographs on glossy paper. I did not want to grow up to be a slutty heiress or a serial killer. I knew that writing was my calling, and I immediately got to work.
Richard Fifield lives in Missoula, Montana. Look for more information about him at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Also there, you'll find poems and children's book reviews, as well as links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis and Tommy Emmanuel. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.